Boom! That bass drops, you know it's time for DLC, your downloadable content for the week. DLC delivered the way it's meant to be, completely free. And that's thanks to our sponsors this week, Mac Mini Colo, MailChimp, and Shopify. They made that possible, bringing the show to you absolutely free. DLC, the show, all about gaming in its many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles, and also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I am your host, Jeff 2Ns1T Kanata, and I'm joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis. The guy who, according to @HawkRod on Twitter, single-handedly saved the Wii U last week with his sales pitch on DLC, Christian Spicer. Welcome, Christian.
Thanks for having me. Speaking of Twitter, if you see something that you like that someone posted on Twitter, use the retweet function or add a little RT in front of it and then tweet it. Don't lift it whole cloth and then post it as your own, because that's stealing. And that's a really crappy thing to do.
Little public service announcement from Christian, protecting free speech for all of us. Thank you, Christian. How do you feel about the console that you constantly deride, you being the savior of it, according to one Twitter user?
I want nothing more than for the Wii U and Nintendo to be a success, and I'm glad to play a small role in making it so. When something is worth a purchase and there's a value add, I will be a champion of it. If you go out and buy it for full price, you know, hopefully you know what you're getting into. That system has a lot of good games and still has not realized its potential, but hopefully if the 2015 calendar holds, it will. And I hope people like their new consoles. By my count, I sold 21 of them. So you're welcome, Nintendo.
Yeah, that's why I said single-handedly saved the Wii U. You 21x the sales of the Wii U this week. DLC, it's your downloadable Kanata, it's your downloadable Christian. But this week, we're very happy to say DLC stands for Documentarian and Legacy Co-Oper, because we've got one of the creative forces behind the original 1UP show, Co-op, and the upcoming video game documentary Outer Lands, Area 5's Ryan O'Donnell joins us. Welcome, Ryan.
Ah, thank you for having me.
It is our pleasure. I'm very excited. Can you give us an update on Outer Lands? You had a successful Kickstarter campaign. Tell us what's going on with that.
It's a long, ongoing shoot. It's funny because we just did, previous to this, two feature-length documentary films, one on Street Fighter called I Am Street Fighter and one about the making of The Last of Us called Grounded, Making The Last of Us. Both are available on YouTube. You can watch them for free.
And both are excellent, I would say.
Thank you very much.
That as well, yes.
Those were the biggest projects that I had tackled before this, that we had tackled as a team at Area 5, and now we're trying to do what is the equivalent of basically six films. And wow. So it's been a real challenge in terms of just, organizing all of that footage and getting all the shoots in line. So that's like the new part of the challenge that's fun. But it's actually going really well. Just the other night, we ended up doing a shoot for one of the topics that we're covering that reminded me of this old, it wasn't even an episode of a 1UP show. It was we basically at some point ripped off John Favreau's Dinner for Five back at 1UP and did an episode of a show that we called RSVP, where we sat four game developers down at a nice restaurant and had them chat about whatever they felt like chatting about. And so for just a tiny little, it'll end up being like the tiniest little segment of one of our upcoming episodes of Outer Lands, but we basically recreated that setup and shot with some very interesting people. And It was so much fun. It reminded me that I would love to do a show just like that again. But it's been great. We're traveling around. We just got through with a 3-week East Coast trip. We're going to be heading out to Evo in a couple weeks for one of the episodes, and then after that, we're looking at going to Argentina and Chile, and then Toronto and Austin and Los Angeles probably. So it's ongoing. So awesome. It's really busy, but it's fun stuff.
Very cool. I have been enjoying, you guys have been putting up little sort of teaser shorts on the blog, and they are very high quality. If anybody's curious about what Outer Lands is going to feel like, check those out. And also check out the previous projects that Ryan mentioned as well. Just such high quality, great video game content. It's fantastic, and I'm a fan. So, of course, we have to start every episode the way we always do, with Story of the Week.
Story of the week, it's the story of the week. Story of the week, it's the story of the week.
Story of the week, of course, the segment of the show where we try to convince each other of the most important story of the week. You can have your voice heard because, of course, DLC is decided by listener contribution, and you can submit your stories of the week all week long using hashtag DLCSOTW. That's DLCSOTW for Story of the Week. And you can also use our subreddit. We now have a subreddit at reddit.com/r/5by5DLC. You can submit stories there as well. But Ryan, I'm curious what you think this week's most important gaming story is.
You know, it's been hard. I've been looking over some of these headlines here. And I guess the quick answer is maybe the Summer Games Done Quick raising over $700,000. Not only because I watched not a ton of it. I mean, I've been working and watching something else, the World Cup that's been on. But I guess the World Cup doesn't really count as gaming news, even though it is gaming. It's been really exciting. But I actually sort of think that the biggest story this week is YouTube adding 60 frames per second support and a tip jar.
Yeah, that could be huge.
Yeah, it's sort of, I mean, we had heard, I honestly can't remember, did it come through that it was true that they were buying Twitch or not?
I
remember at some point Google was talking about it.
Yeah, I think that is happening. Yeah, I think that is confirmed as far as I'm
okay,
aware.
Okay, so to me, this is like really interesting because obviously Twitch has Let's Plays sort of, you know, totally locked down, people are making a significant living doing that. And then there are other YouTubers that are making a significant living off of, you know, doing videos on YouTube. But this adding of 60 frames per second and tip jar straight into the YouTube, you know, user interface just makes it so much easier for new people to get involved in this if it's something they're interested in doing. And I really do think it legitimizes, I don't know, gameplay videos on the site. It seems like a almost an about face from before when they were taking down any videos with gameplay footage due to copyright violations. Mm-hmm. And also Vimeo in the past has often done things that aren't really great to game developers, like taking down their gameplay footage and stuff like that. So I think it says a lot about the future of broadcast on the internet that YouTube is making this change, and I think it's going to end up being relatively important going forward.
Yeah, there doesn't really seem to be any reason to use 60 frames on a YouTube video other than gameplay footage, so that certainly seems to be a concession. It says that there's launch support for 48 frames and 60 frames. 48, I guess, if you wanted to put up, like, you know, legitimate Lord of the Rings, or excuse me, The Hobbit, you know, movie clips.
Right, exactly.
but the 60 frames, it's really about gameplay footage. And that does, as you indicate, seems to be an embracing of, hey, this is a place, this is a destination to go to see gameplay footage, which is in direct opposition to yanking people down for copyright infringement. So I think this is going to continue to evolve, and there's going to be, you know, there's going to be stories, I think, in the next several months of different companies having different approaches. Certainly Nintendo has been going back and forth trying to figure out where they stand. They evidently now want a cut of YouTube video profits and Twitch profits in order to have Nintendo videos on those, you know, straight gameplay footage on those sites. So I think different companies are going to take different approaches, but it's definitely nice to see YouTube adding the support for it natively. And this tip jar thing is really cool. I want to know exactly how it's going to be implemented. Like, is it going to be a one-off, like, hey, I liked your getting hit in the nuts video, I'm going to give you a dollar? Or is it more along the lines of a Patreon type model where I can sign up, and if I subscribe to your channel, I can give you a tip every week or something? You know, I'm very interested to see how that's all going to play out.
I agree. And I think that if I had a criticism of this move, it's that it is called the tip jar. Vimeo has a tip jar already implemented. It's something they put in a while ago, and it's for, you know, exactly what it implies: tipping creators a little bit of money if you like their work to try to help keep them, you know, financially, able to create more stuff.
Yeah.
But I sort of wish it had a little bit more legitimate, I don't know, more serious sounding name.
And, yeah, like a support system or something. Yeah.
Exactly. And I don't think the answer as to whether or not, say, the game creators, whether or not they should be compensated for it is an answered question. In fact, I think there are a lot of great arguments on both sides. And so, to me, the term tip jar sort of just implies, like, okay, this money is just going to the person that created this video. Whereas it would be easier to sort of separate out the money that a particular creator is bringing in, giving a small chunk of it to the game creator. Maybe that would be more reasonable if a system was put in place for it. But anyway, it seems like this is a good first step into allowing YouTube users some way beyond ad support to try to make a little bit of money off their stuff directly in the platform. And I really like that. I mean, that's aside. It just seems like it's a little bit less. It's asking the creators to go to their audience for money rather than having to work with Google on a much larger, you know, sort of deal to get some funding for a project. And I like that.
Yeah. Christian, you want to weigh in on this one?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I agree with much of what you guys have said, that it's a good first step. But I feel like, you know, I don't, maybe it's me being naive, but I don't feel like it was YouTube, you know, or Google that was like demanding that the footage be taken down. And they get pressure. They're a very large company, and then they get pressure from other large companies and copyright infringement they have to take seriously. So, you know, they're kind of on that end of things when they then ask things to be taken down, or they have the software in place that checks for copyright infringement. And then, you know, if this tip jar comes in, like, what happens if your channel is, if I'm just, this is just an example, right? If I'm just Mario Kart 8 footage and I have this tip jar and I've been making all this money, you know, is it possible then for Nintendo or, you know, whatever that company is that would make a copyright claim to go after what is in that tip jar? And I think it'll be interesting to see how this evolves and see how it plays out. But it is interesting. I think people are trying to figure out a way to make this work. And YouTube has consistently been trying to find ways to keep the creators that make quality content or sometimes it's different, but quality / much viewed, consistently heavy viewed content, you know, using their platform, whether it be when Google and YouTube gave people money, you know, directly, like some big channels got money to make content, or the YouTube space here in the Los Angeles area. You know, they want to make this a thing that works and is more of a platform for curated or quality content and not just ball to groin type videos. And I think this is another step in that direction. Google tries a lot of things, and I think more often than not, they end up pulling support for it down the line. Like, I was one of the few people who really liked Google Wave, and then that went away. But hopefully it works out. And, you know, it's not maybe as nice or elegant as a system as Patreon might be, but it's something, you know, like Ryan was saying, that you can have directly there on your channel, and you can still have a link to a Patreon in your show description or something like that, which requires a little more work to get people to click over. But I think it's encouraging, and I'm curious to see how it plays out. I think the biggest question is what happens when, you know, some of these people are making tip money by using quote-unquote copyrighted material. What does Google then do to that pressure?
Yeah. I want to hit on the other story that Ryan brought up as well, which is definitely a feel-good story. Summer Games Done Quick, which is a bunch of guys that get together and speed run games and Twitch stream them for charity. The charity specifically is Doctors Without Borders, which is a fantastic charity. And they raised $713,000 in their summer marathon. And that marks a combined total of more than $2.75 million raised this year by Games Done Quick, which is awesome. It's very entertaining to watch these guys. They're so clever and skilled, quite honestly, to be able to get through these games quickly. It's fun to watch an entire game done in like 5 minutes. And it's great. It's a great cause. So I definitely want to underscore that story that Ryan brought up. You guys watch these?
One of the things that's great about it is that the commentary, like the players are often, you know, this is a long marathon. They played these games hundreds, thousands of times, but so they have a familiarity with them that's insane. But it's sometimes they're just really great commentators as well. So it's amazing to me that they can not only play this quickly and sometimes with very few errors, but also, you know, tell you exactly what they're doing, which makes it easy for someone who maybe hasn't ever seen that game played before, understand why they're doing is significant. Like I watched a speed run through Castlevania 64, which mm-hmm. is not a very good Castlevania game. And I've never played it before. And it was still super interesting to watch because the commentary was so solid.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to hear how it's this group puzzle solving that as a group, it's, you know, the dozen or 20 or whatever it is, guys that are working to improve times on a specific game are all sort of sharing concepts with each other, or, you know, so-and-so discovered this thing, so I lifted that, and so-and-so discovered that thing, and now we realize that if you dash over here, you can break this part of the game and skip this section. It's like, it's a fascinating lesson in groupthink and in puzzle solving, and this wonderful meta game that's happening on top of an actual game. It's great.
Yeah, and beyond that, I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, the person who gets the quickest run, you know, gets the glory until someone else comes along and beats it. But it really is like a team effort where everyone's sharing ideas. And these Summer Games Done Quick, these Video Games Done Quick marathons that have raised so much money for these different charities. I mean, the whole thing has this really great we sort of feeling, and it doesn't seem like it's out about any individual person, and it really, to me, it's like the best of what gaming community and gaming culture shows about, you know, shows to the outside world.
Yeah, so say we all. There is an individual though that did make some news in this area, and that is a guy named Blubber, who is the official new world record holder this week of fastest Super Mario Brothers playthrough. He did it in 4 minutes 57 seconds, and it's a very specific category. It's what's it called? Any percentage is the designation. So that means you can use warps, and he beat the previous record holder by almost a full, what is it, 2 seconds? I'm trying to find it here. Yeah. So the previous record was 4:59, so he had like a full second and a half of faster, which is a huge, huge mark in this realm, because guys are shaving seconds all the time, and the mark had been a real high water mark for the record. And this is a game that's been around for so long; shaving seconds off is a huge accomplishment. So, new world record for Super Mario Brothers. Done quick.
It's funny how it doesn't seem like a couple seconds is that big a deal until you watch some of these races that they do. Like in the marathon, I was watching a Symphony of the Night race where two speedrunners were going at it side by side. And at some point, you know, when one person sort of gets out into a little bit of a lead, it seems like the other player is so far behind, even though, you know, it probably only take them 5-10 seconds to catch up to what the other player is doing. But every second matters in speedrunning, the same way it does in any sort of race. It's it's fantastic and it's fascinating.
I'm just glad this came out because it finally proves that Super Mario Brothers is a dumb game and not worth your money when you bought it when you were a kid, because it could be beaten so quickly. So time spent per dollar spent investment clearly proves. And there was no multiplayer. What a poor value proposition! Like, what a crappy game. So
hey, there's multiplayer. One person can play as Luigi.
No competitive multiplayer. Worst game.
It's competitive. It's got points, you know. I'm sure I could outscore you in Super Mario Brothers if if it all came right down to it.
Accepted.
Perfect.
All right.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I got to go. Ryan and I got some gaming to do.
Amazing. Christian, before you go, what is your story of the week this week?
Succinctly, it's Millions. Because there are so many stories
and
that have
millions.
have millions in them. But for me, what I'm picking is the news that came out that Minecraft on consoles is the bigger seller versus PC. And it's somewhat, you know, maybe this gets a duh from people because it includes every console iteration. But for a game that came out on PC well before it came out on consoles and arguably is the best version on PC with a bigger world, more items, things getting updated quicker versus waiting for the, you know, larger patches or updates on the console versions. That to me was a surprise. And I guess it's like 54 million total copies of iPrint Money have
Holy
been sold.
Holy crap, man. That is just insane.
It's interesting. And that's across all platforms. But, I mean, I guess that serves as a reminder that it seems like whatever it was 10 years ago, people were saying the PC is dead. And now this console generation, you know, people are talking about how, you know, the consoles are on their way out and, you know, you just have a PC and the PC is the way to go and PC gaming's the best. And, you know, whatever the merits of that argument may or may not be, console gaming is still very important and can be a big moneymaker for any type of game. And I think Minecraft is the current example of that.
I wonder if those numbers include Android and iOS as consoles, or if they're considered part of the PC. I would assume that they are considered consoles and not PC, even though, to me, it's like mobile, console, and PC all feel a bit different. Anyway, mm-hmm. I was really surprised by this news as well, because, you know, it just seems like you hear about Minecraft being taught in schools and every, you know, so many kids in the world all over playing it. It seems like PC would be the primary platform. So I was really surprised to hear that it's sold more on console, and it's not even out for PS4, Vita, or Xbox One yet. It's coming out in a couple months, and you know, that means that those numbers should just continue to increase.
Yeah, when it comes out on Vita, there will be at least two more sales, me and the other guy that likes the Vita.
That's me. I'm the Vita guy. I'm the other Vita guy.
We found each other.
Yeah, this is amazing. Hey, nice to finally see you. This is awesome.
Yeah,
I love the Vita.
It explains why the Near app never worked, because we're so far away from each other and we're the only two.
your guys' Super Mario Brothers score showdown is going to turn into just Vita high-fiving.
That's right. We can't play it on Vita, so we're not going to end up playing it at all.
Yeah.
I think that you bring up a really great point, Ryan, about what qualification is the mobile stuff in. And I would guess that you're correct that it is counted as a console, quote unquote, console sale. It certainly wouldn't be considered a PC sale. And if there's only two categories, I'm guessing that's the bucket it gets dropped in. And I just my, you know, own personal experience with my nephews, they would rather play it on a phone or a iPod Touch than they would sitting down at a computer. They want to have it on the go. They want to sit on the couch and kind of curl up with it. So it kind of makes some sense to me. The number itself, the 54 million number, is so staggering that I say this all the time, but it needs to be underscored also, is Minecraft is a generational game. This game is, there's going to be a whole generation of kids that are going to define what games are through the lens of Minecraft. And I think us old fogies who grew up with games that had scores like Super Mario Brothers, had levels, had quests, had goals, had things that you had to do in order to quote unquote beat them or complete them. All of that is going to be a completely superfluous concept to kids that want experiences like Minecraft. And I think when those kids come of age and start designing games themselves, I think we're going to be in for some really wild, interesting experiences.
Yeah, I agree.
Totally.
And it's exciting to me. I love the idea that this one product can have such a huge impact. And I'm so – I keep waiting for there to be more and more ripoffs, quite honestly, or games that, of that genre. And we've seen some, you know, Terraria and others. And there are definitely things like the new EverQuest is going to have aspects of it. Even WildStar, which I've been playing, has aspects of, like, you know, creating your own environment and building things within it. But I think that this is going to go so much farther in the next 5 to 10 years when the reach of Minecraft really blossoms, really comes to fruition. So
yeah, I agree. And it's weird because the games that are sort of inspired by it are so sometimes so on the nose, like Terraria, like you said. But I think No Man's Sky is another example of something that takes the lessons learned from something like Minecraft and then does its own thing with it, which, you know, it's obviously probably not going to be have quite as large an impact as Minecraft does. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I'm just guessing here, but, you know, it's still that procedurally generated huge universe that goes on forever that you just never know what you're going to find. I think that's part of the appeal of Minecraft as well.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, he even, what's his name? The lead designer.
Sean Murray.
Sean Murray. Yeah. He even references that and saying that, that he, when in describing the game to a certain age level, he, you know, has to explain, like, well, you know, you don't, there's not really quests. You just go to do things. And then he says to us, below a certain age level, no one asks him those questions. No one cares. Yep. That they just accept it, like, oh, that you're creating this amazing universe for me to wander around in and find my own fun. I get that. I don't have any expectation of anything different than that. And I think that that's really going to be a major demarcation line in, you know, generational shift from what games are to what they will be.
I, as one of, you know, the older generation who does usually care about things like quests and objectives and that sort of thing, it's surprising. When I heard him say that, you know, when you hear that, like, oh, kids don't care about these things, I find it hugely inspiring and just like a sort of lovely development, because though the complexity is stuff you can add on later, but if you can make an experience just fun to play around in and be in a world to live in, you know, that's the start. Like, that's the base of what the experience should be. And then all the other stuff, we've already learned how to do all that in the last 30, 40 years of game development, or throughout the entire history of game design, not in video games, but in the world of play. You know, we can add all that stuff in later. I love that kids are getting this new taste that they didn't have the same sort of upbringing in games that we did.
Yeah. Right? I completely agree with you. It's inspiring to me as well. It gives me this wonderful sense of hope, because I think it represents a level of independent thinking that it's not like, tell me the instructions to follow and I will follow them. It's a kind of fun that says, I don't need instructions. I just need a playground, and I will, you know, empower my imagination to create circumstances in which I have fun, my friends have fun. You know, games like DayZ, these are, I think, the new generation of games. And it's because technology allows people to play together, and the internet allows information to be shared, and it's the MMOification of things, but the stripping away of the on railsness, the
yes,
strict definition of what you should be doing. I think it's great.
It reminds me of being a kid too, because, you know, back when we were playing those early NES games or whatever, like The Legend of Zelda, it was all about sort of not knowing what you could do and about pressing the outside barriers of what was possible within the, you know, mechanical architecture of the game.
Yeah.
And you know, bombing every wall, like setting every bush on fire,
right,
and just trying to find what was out there. And sure, something like Minecraft that doesn't really have objectives has maybe less of that, but that's not even true. Like, you keep bombing, you're going to find some cave, or you're going to figure out some new crafting thing that you can build that you didn't know about before. That stuff is so exciting, and it's just so nice to me that it's come back in a way that feels totally new and different from what it was like when we were younger. And also, you know, we've got things like Dark Souls coming back into style, and which mm-hmm. sort of are reminiscent of those old gameplay ideas as well.
You know? What yeah. I love so much about the game is that, you know, how it was made or who it was made by, and versus, you know, being Dungeon Keeper by EA, the mobile version of Dungeon Keeper, or, you know, like it was built to be this play forever, explore the world, thousands and thousands of items, new items being introduced all the time. And it wasn't built upon a free to play microtransaction. You know what I mean? It was built so outside of what a lot of this type of game, had it been developed, quote unquote, by like a big developer, would have been forced into the game design doc. And instead of crippling the game with that kind of stuff, it's, you know, it exploded with creativity and has made so much money. And I think it's refreshing to see that, where it's, you know, building something cool and great and good and fun can be enough and can be successful, versus how are we going to monetize this? And, well, we got to squeeze every penny out of every item and everything. And that's probably one of my favorite things about Minecraft and the community that it's built, I think, because of that, because it fostered creativity versus stepped on it or tried to, you know, charge for it.
Yeah.
It's Legos before Legos got licenses, right? And you just got a big bucket of Legos and you built whatever the heck you wanted to build. And now you get a thing of Legos and you build, you know, whatever it is, the Batmobile. And that's cool, but it's a very different Lego set than just a big bucket of Legos that I had when I was little.
I mean, really, it's the lesson of the Lego movie. It's, you know, you don't have to follow the instructions that come with the Lego thing. It's there for you to build whatever you want. But anyway, speaking of monetizing things, we have to thank our sponsors. First among them, MailChimp. MailChimp.com means easy email newsletters. So if you have any reason to talk to a group of people via a newsletter, MailChimp helps you. You can design email newsletters, share them on social networks, integrate them with services you already use, and track your results. It's like your own personal publishing platform, which, say that three times fast. You can customize your newsletter sign up to match your brand. You can share your sign up on your website and your Facebook page. You can even collect sign ups from an iPad or a laptop. So if you're wandering around and you need to be mobile, you're at a meeting, you're at an event, you're at a party, and you want to collect some sign ups to people, keep people informed via your newsletter, just use your iPad or your laptop. You can even import existing email lists if you have some, no matter the format. You get to personalize what your subscribers see, including sign-up forms and confirmation emails. And right now is the best time ever to try MailChimp, because they've got their new entrepreneur plan. So if you have under 2,000 subscribers, you can send 12,000 emails per month forever. Just visit MailChimp.com/5x5 to learn more. That's MailChimp.com/5x5. Learn how to send and design and maintain easy email newsletters. We thank MailChimp for supporting DLC, and we hope you support them in return. Christian, you brought up the idea of this sort of, you know, is PC gaming dying? Is console gaming in a surge right now? I think this information that we got this week from Valve about the Steam sale leading to 8 million concurrent users is pretty good indication that PCs are doing just fine. It's evidently the end of the Steam sale yesterday. There were just over 8 million users, and that back in January, they said that Steam has reached 75 million active users in total, which is up from 65 million in October. That's crazy.
It was 8 million concurrent users.
8 million concurrent.
One moment in time.
And 75 million active users. I don't know how they define active, but that's a pretty darn hefty install base, I would say. I think that shows that, I mean, we're seeing it already with all these next gen, or I guess current gen now, titles being released on PC as well. Nobody's ignoring the PC market. The Steam sale shows that discounting these games can, you know, yield fantastic sales. Steam is a platform that's not going anywhere. I think PC is a pretty darn safe bet if you've got the money to pony up for one. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think what I was saying earlier was, I think it was like 10 years ago when people were arguing that the PC, you know, was dead. You heard that argument a lot. And now I feel like you almost hear the reverse, where people are arguing that, you know, consoles are on their way out. So I was using the Minecraft example as saying, I think both are pretty healthy right now. I mean, what Steam's able to do is incredible, and the numbers they're able to drive is incredible. And I'm one of those people that, you know, I like Steam, and I think they do a lot right, but I would like to see, well, there are some competitors I think are good. Like, you know, anytime this discussion comes up, I think I like to mention Good Old Games. I think they do a great job, and they have a good pricing structure, and it's, you know, DRM-free, and, you know, a good catalog of games that you otherwise weren't able to play.
Right.
And I'd like to see Origin... and God forbid, even Uplay work. You know, like, I think if there is even more competition in this space, I think oftentimes people talk about competition in the console space. And, you know, when the Xbox One was doing poorly, people were like, I want it to do well because competition is good. But then when you talk about hoping that Origin succeeds, people try to kill you with their eyes. But it's the same thing, right? If Origin... you know, got its act together, and I think they are becoming better despite, you know, Battlefield 4 and game launches within the EA infrastructure. I'd like to see more of these things, because while Steam does pretty much everything right, one company ruling the PC market becomes scary at times also. But yeah, the PC is not going anywhere anytime soon for a gaming platform.
It's funny that you talk about that, because... what I feel like what I want as an intelligent consumer is at odds with what I actually want as a gamer.
Totally. 'Cause
what I really want is everything, you know, I like all my games on PC to come through Steam.
Mm-hmm.
I want all my indie games to be on the PlayStation platform, so I get cross buy and cross save and all that stuff. So I can play on Vita when I'm on the go and PS4 when I'm at home. You know, I want all of my phone stuff to be coming through the App Store so that I don't have to think about that.
Right.
And, you know, these little walled gardens that work well for me, at, you know, based on the type of stuff that I like, but doesn't really help, you know, in my perfect world, everything comes to those platforms that I really like. Everything comes to PC, Mac, PC, Linux, and is, you know, right through Steam, but it's, you know, creating those basically monopolies is not good for us, because that means that we can get screwed over in the end. So
yeah, I want choice.
I think what you're saying is a good thing to keep in mind, you know, that like it's bad for us.
Yeah, you want choice, but it'd be nice if it was the choice that I made.
Right. Exactly.
I like there to be choice, but you know what? I already made a choice. So if it only has to come out on one platform, let it be that one. Yeah, I get that.
But going back to the start of this, I think I have a lot of friends right now that are typically console gamers in the past, but now, I don't know, because of the price of consoles, because new consoles have basically the same games oftentimes that, you know, are also coming out on PC, they've decided at least this gen to sort of begin to sit it out and see what happens. Let the console manufacturers make a more convincing argument with first-party software, and are just perfectly content right now to play games to build out their Steam library instead of buying a bunch of console games at the beginning of this generation. And that's not me. I own all of the current generation consoles, and I actually end up playing all three of them quite a bit. And that's great for me, but I totally understand the alternate perspective as well.
Well, I definitely agree that my story of the week is the Games Done Quick achievement of getting 700 grand. That's just fantastic. But there's several.
Oh, but we've entered the part of the show where Jeff just rambles off every other story now. And...
Well, there's several that were submitted, so we gotta see some listener stories of the week, including one that is close to my heart as well. Was submitted by @BrandMartin06, who pointed us to the fact that the Curse of Naxxramas expansion to Hearthstone has been confirmed for this month. By Blizzard, and some interesting information, including we're releasing pricing details next week. So the week that starts today, so we'll talk about it in next week's episode, I'm sure, they're going to talk about pricing details, which is like, well, okay, you have a free-to-play game that has in-game purchases of decks. Are the decks going to be priced different? Are they going to, are you going to be able to buy a specific Curse of Naxxramas deck? It's got a sort of single-player campaign mode. Do I have to buy that specifically? I'm a little worried that this expansion is going to be broken up into a bunch of little transactions instead of me able to buy it for $10 or whatever. It's going to be interesting to see, but I'm very excited because I'm such a Hearthstone addict that I'm very excited that it's coming this month. Ryan, do you play Hearthstone?
I dabbled a little bit just because I wanted to see what the hype was all like about, I guess is the best way to put it. And I think it's actually really, really great. It isn't exactly my cup of tea, but...
Wait, you wanted to see what the what was all about?
The hype.
Choo-choo!
Sorry.
Yeah, it was... I think it's an extremely well-designed game. It's got that classic Blizzard polish, and it's wonderful, but I never bought any packs, can't imagine buying any packs, and yeah, this is a very interesting development. I would imagine... I just can't imagine them charging for the expansion itself, right? It's yeah. just going to be like a free update through
the App Stores.
So. Or maybe it's an in-app purchase. I guess that's possible, too. Maybe they haven't made made enough money back on selling the individual packs as much as they thought they would. And so deciding to charge for the expansion is, you know, a sort of bandage for that.
Oh, I'm sure they've made gobs of money on that game. I can only imagine. But one of the great things about Hearthstone, at least from my perspective, is that you can legitimately enjoy the game without ever spending a real human dollar. That you can grind those quests and earn that gold and buy packs. And really, you can make a very suitable deck for without a lot of, you know, epic level cards in it. You know, it feels like if they're going to be similar to the real world CCG or, TCG game model, it would be that you would buy when you went to the store to buy a pack, you would decide if I'm going to buy a regular Hearthstone deck pack or I'm going to buy this new expansion pack. But since there is this weird single player component content, I'm curious how they're monetizing that. It's going to be really interesting to see. I hope that they maintain a commitment to allowing people to enjoy the game in a free way should they choose, because that's certainly how I've been doing it. And I'm very excited about this content. So I'm a little nervous, to be honest.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Another couple of stories I want to hit on because they were submitted by users. What do you guys think of this... I hesitate to even talk about it because it kind of falls in the rumor category, but it was submitted by a bunch of people, including at Dreamwinder, and it's on the subreddit, the DLC subreddit. Crytek, supposedly in trouble. We've had all these stories about developers having layoffs and everything, but this is a little bit more disturbing in the sense that supposedly, according to Kotaku, there's several confirmed, although anonymous, sources from Crytek who have claimed that they have not been getting checks on time and that there's been a bunch of canceled games at Crytek and things are in disarray. What do you guys think about this? Christian, what's your take?
I was forming my thoughts in my head, and I don't mean this to sound as cold as it's going to come out. As a company, I don't care. They can go away. That's fine. I don't care. Rare's still around, but they're not the Rare that I love. You know what I mean? Criterion's back with their 2047 game or whenever it comes out, 3117 or whenever the new Criterion game comes out. But that's not Criterion. That's not my Criterion. If Crytek goes away, I don't care. Oh, whatever. But I'm not cold and heartless. I hope, you know, I feel bad for any individuals that lose their jobs, and that's unfortunate. But like, what is the company? Okay, so they have an engine. We don't need that engine. There are other engines out there, and I think that there are talented people that can make a new engine. What people are doing with Unity is amazing, and you know that's not even quote unquote, the most robust most advanced engine out there. So whatever. If the company goes away, that's fine. THQ went away. What? Who cares? You know what I mean? Like, as a company level, who cares? On an individual level, I hope everyone finds new jobs and lands on their feet as quickly as possible. But at the end of the day, there won't be a Crysis 4. I like the Crysis games, but who cares? There'll be another good game that comes out. Like, we're not... It's not as if there's only one company making games, and if they go away, I won't play them anymore. And so I feel like that's always my reply to these things, where they're probably not even the same. They're not. I mean, they're not the same Crytek that made Far Cry 1. You know what I mean? So it's just like, who cares?
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's so complicated to be a AAA developer in this space. And they are as big as you can possibly get. Not only do they make these giant, bombastic, huge, graphically intense video games that run on the beefiest of machines, but they also, as you mentioned, have an engine that they make, which puts them up just like the likes of Unreal, or, I mean, even Unity. Unity isn't a game developer. They don't publish games. They just make the engine, right?
Right.
So they're in this really small category of publishers / developers now. It's really a weird space, and if you don't have a company of hundreds of people employed. But I just think the market is doesn't have space for the sort of big budget games that don't perform really, really well.
The chat room, Trojan says the worst news about the Crytek stuff is no Rise 2. Rise was super fun and had a lot of potential. I know a lot of people derided Rise for sort of cookie cutter Simon Says gaming. I never actually played it, but I had heard some people liked it a little bit more than that. And certainly it's hard to judge launch titles, because you know that there is such a strict window of when it has to come out, and that game was definitely a day one launch title despite whatever state the game was going to be in. And I would agree that it's a bummer that it seems like that it won't get a second crack at it with maybe a little bit more time and resources to get it right. Because it was an interesting milieu. Maybe they could have figured out a way to make that franchise a little bit more interesting and varied the gameplay up a little bit. It's an unfortunate story if it's true. But again, just a rumor, unsubstantiated. Last story I'll bring up here, because it was submitted with that hashtag by at PsychoCross. Dota 2 International has now crossed the $10 million mark for its prize pool. Holy crap. It's the biggest esports prize pool in the history of mankind. And we've talked about this before, but it's just worth noting that they crossed this milestone. I don't think you even need to say it legitimizes Dota. Dota is legit. Esports is legit. $10 million is no joke. I would like to focus on the way that this money has been raised and how smart Valve has been about doing it, selling that compendium, putting a portion of the proceeds into the prize pool, rewarding people for getting invested in the outcome of these things. It's just such a brilliant way to make your game seem vital, to create drama within the community, within the people who are excited about these matches anyway, and raise the level of awareness. It seems exciting to me.
It's been so interesting to watch Valve turn into the developer of games that were my favorite. You know, they used to be my favorite developer back when Half-Life 2 and Portal and Team Fortress 2 were coming out. And they've definitely had a shift in terms of what their focus is. And over the past, I don't know, 5-10 years, it's been so interesting to watch that shift, because even though they're not making games that are really for me so much anymore, they are making outstanding games and smart choices. And they seem so much closer to like a Blizzard to me than they once were. But God, so smart. And I love the way they treat their audience. It seems like everyone who is into Dota is super into the way they've been, you know, handling that product.
Yeah,
great.
For sure. Any comment on that, Christian? Are you going to be watching?
I won't watch it live. I mean, I don't have the time. I won't. Maybe I'll be running in the background while I do something else. But I think it's great. That's kind of all there is to say. I think it's great.
All right, cool. Let's move right on to the playlist then. Don't forget, you can weigh in with your opinions. We're going to be going to the phones, 512-518-5714. They were down last week, but they're up this week. They are back. So if you want to call in and have your opinion heard, your voice on the show, 512-518-5714 is that number. Ryan, what is on your playlist this week?
Well, I've been playing a lot of what everyone else on my Twitter feed, anyway, has been playing, which is Shovel Knight. It's really, really, really good for a lot
now,
of different
talk about
reasons.
Games from our, from a certain generation, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, everyone. It's so easy to sort of to quickly try to sum it up by saying, "Oh, it takes this element." Like, you know, I guess I'll do it right now. You know, it's it feels like the map screen in the game is a very reminiscent of like a cross between Super Mario Brothers 3 and Bionic Commando. The towns are like the Legend of Zelda 2, Adventures of Link. It's the combat sort of has its own flavor by, you know, with the normal shovel swipes, but then you have a downward attack that feels a lot like riding the cane in DuckTales.
Yeah.
The boss battles feel a bit like Mega Man boss battles. So it has like all these different elements from these NES games from our childhood, but it still, you know, has an identity of its own as well. And it all feels cohesive. And I don't know, it's just a wonder to play. And beyond that, I think the thing that really makes it feel distinctly retro, I think that's the most interesting thing, is there's so many games now that you know, side-scrolling puzzle platformers and platformers action games have come back into the public eye in the past few years. These games oftentimes take a lot of the sort of retro mechanics but then update and modernize them. This game actually does feel rather old. You know, some of the, like, the jumping is you can't really turn on a dime. You do have to be deliberate. The same is true with your shovel swipes, your attacks. You really can't button mash so much. It doesn't turn out to be a smart way to play. You really have to be deliberate, time your strikes well, and you know, I guess when I'm doing my mathematical equation of this plus this plus this in terms of the games, you know, adding Dark Souls to the mix would be another one. They handle checkpoints in a really, really incredible way that allows you to sort of risk reward your money, which is your only resource that you're really gathering in the game, by, if you die, some bags of gold or jewels or whatever are left in the place where you died, and it's up to you to determine whether or not you want to go back and grab them. There's no arbitrary lives. That's the only currency that you're really worrying about. And then you can decide to destroy checkpoints and gain additional cash for that, which I think is a really cool mechanic that we haven't seen anywhere else.
Yeah.
Something about it is just like this really great mix of just a few modern elements, whether it's widescreen support or, you know, this checkpointing system, but with a game that really does feel like almost like a lost NES game. It's really something. I really, really enjoy it.
Christian, you've been playing that as well, right?
Yeah, it's so good. Man, a lot of what Ryan said, I would just reiterate. What I love about when you die, it's an updated twist or borrowed from a Dark Souls esque type game, or kind of like a roguelike to some extent, of when you die. Like, the punishment for death, like, there aren't lives. You'll never run out of continues, which I feel like is a smart way to update this style of game, because, you know, that's not why people are playing games anymore. It's not, you know, that appeal has kind of worn off. But by losing money, which is how you upgrade your character, and sometimes you die a lot, like, it has a Mega Man feel to it where when you die, it's usually, I mean, it's fair. It's fair when you die, but still frustrating. You know what I mean? Like, some levels, like Mario 3, maybe Mega Man's had these too, but what's coming to mind is the Mario floating ship levels, where the level is moving despite you. And if you get caught off screen, you die. So it's forcing you through the level. You don't know what's up ahead. You do a jump that you think is going to be your best jump, but then you hit a spike and that's a one-hit death. So it's frustrating, but fair in that old school way. And then there are times where I was just, you know, you die like seven times in a row, and it's just like, you see that money going away, and you're just like, oh man, so
it literally flies away with little wings.
Yeah, and then you can go back and get it if you want. And also, I really think it's smart. It's cool the way the checkpointing system works, where if you're in a level, I think every level has 5 checkpoints throughout it, and they're pretty well spaced. There was one level, I'm maybe 3/4 of the way through the game, but there was one level where I was like, oh, I just got to get through this one part, and then there's gonna be a checkpoint right there, and I got through, and I just like jumped across into the next, you know, to push the screen forward, and then there was a guy there, and I died. It's cool that if you can hit these checkpoints, or if you're an idiot, no, if you want to, you can destroy them, and they drop some fat loot. But then, of course, if you die, you go back to the previous checkpoint, and you lose that checkpoint. And it's like little things like that that are really smart, I think, kind of risk reward elements to the game. And as Ryze was saying, like the map is very much Mario 3, even down to like the enemies that kind of free roam the map. And like when you come out of level, it's like makes that little noise as they move to the next part and block your path. The writing, I think, is done really well. It's not, you know, the funniest game I've ever played, but it's also not cringeworthy. I think it strikes that balance right between your character and the interactions he has with the other knights. It's $15. I'm playing it on the 3DS, and I tweeted, like, if you're over 25 and have the money, I would say it's a must-buy. If you're younger than that, I don't know, because I don't know, you know, if you've played Mega Man 9 or Mega Man 10 and enjoyed them, then I could wholeheartedly recommend this game. But if you know, if you're not exposed to this type of side scroller, this type of game, I'm curious what people think of it. But man, it's great. The controls, I agree with Ryan, you know, you can't turn on a dime the way you can, like, you know, double jump out of a jump or whatever. But I wanted to say that the controls are tight. Like, you know where you can jump and where you can't. It's not like a little big planet kind of floating, like you're in the middle of a jump and then you die. But it's great. Jeff, did you pick it up?
I did. What console are you playing on, a console or PC, Ryan?
So I'm playing on PC, and it's actually been really interesting because I started playing with a Xbox One controller since the drivers just came out for that. Mm-hmm. And I found that I didn't like the way it was controlling on the D-pad, so I ended up switching to the analog stick. And then I realized, like, this can't be right. Like, you know, there's no way that people are playing this on Wii U with an analog stick or 3DS for that matter. So I ended up using a DualShock 4 during my second session, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, okay, there. That's how it's supposed to feel. And so this was the game that made me realize that as much as I like entering redeem codes on the Xbox One controller with the D-pad still isn't great for 2D games on the Xbox One controller, and that makes me sad. But yes, yeah. I'm playing on PC, and it's been, you know, a fine way to play it. I sort of wish I was playing on Vita and PS4, but you know, that's just the way I always feel.
I ended up buying it on Steam as well, which I'm hearing you talk about playing it on 3DS, Christian, I kind of wish that's the direction I had gone, because I feel like that had it would probably feel more right there. I'm playing it with a 360 controller because that's the only controller that I have that works with my PC. But I, hearing you talk, Ryan, I think I should probably go out and get a adapter for my DualShock, because yeah, it's hard playing it with the analog stick, and that 360 D-pad is useless.
Yeah. Yeah, so. I really think it's. I honestly, it'll change. It changes the feel of the game so much. Like, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, but I am digging it. I mean, it's one of those things where you turn it on and you're instantly having fun. There's just something that's pure fun about those old games and that concept. I really dig, people keep talking about the music. I love the music. I love the emphasis on the music, that you can collect those musical sheets, and, you know, it really throws that old 8-bit music in front and center and kind of celebrates it, which is fun as well. The combat is really entertaining. The platforming is great. As you were saying, Christian, you never feel like, even if you're jumping to a very, very tiny little peg that's in the middle of water or something, you never feel like you can't make that jump. You know, you never, you definitely feel like you have control. And the DuckTales-esque, you know, down attack, it feels super powerful. It's really fun. It helps propel you to other platforms. That is a really great mechanic that I remember from the old days. My only bit of a bah humbug is, I guess I don't have as much nostalgia for the old 8-bit graphics as others of my generation. I love me some 16-bit look. My favorite game of last year was Rogue Legacy. I love games that are of that 2D sprite mentality, but don't go full 8-bit. I just feel like, probably because I'm playing it on my giant PC screen, like 2 feet from my face, or a foot and a half from my face, whatever it is, that it just looks garish and a little bit. What we gain from nostalgia for the 8-bit look, I feel like isn't worth the.
I know. I love it.
Me too.
And it's not, to be fair, it's not. I mean, he did a blog post, I don't know if it was the full development team on it or whatever, but, you know, this technically couldn't run on an NES, and they outlined some of the difference. It does have more color than was available in an NES, but it was very much that look. But I think it's such a beautiful, beautiful 8-bit style game where, you know, the backgrounds are amazing. There's one where you're, you know, it's like a sunset. And every time you wake up in your campfire, man,
it's nostalgic, and I definitely have nostalgia for those kinds of games, those looks. I mean, I feel like, I'm literally having sense memory at some points of oh my gosh, I remember how this felt to play these games. Like, I don't know, I could name off 12 games you guys have all played, but.
I want to show, next time we're together, I'll show you on the 3DS, and maybe that is the difference, because it's so perfect on that screen, and also I'm used to playing like Mario 3 and stuff like that on that screen, so I could see how, yeah, if you're on like 32-inch widescreen, you're just playing Wildstar. And
I disagree. I'm playing on my computer, but I have it running through my television at whatever, 40 inches or something like that, and it's I think it's glorious. I love the 8-bit plus look with the super clean, you know, clean but ultra colorful graphics that weren't possible on the NES, and the parallax in the backgrounds is really nice. I don't know if you've gotten to there's like that one space where you go to meet like the Fish King and when he does his like he comes up and does a dance, or even there's like the woman in the town that does a little dance for you. That is like, I don't know, I love those the amount of animation. It does remind me of what it used to be like to play those games, but in this like the best new way. And you were talking about the music, Jeff. Vert, who's the composer of most of the tracks, as far as I know, he used he basically designed the music within the capability range of the NES, so it has this like really precise NES sounding music that just it takes me right back. But to
and
me,
even
again,
the sound effects.
Oh yeah, totally. To me, the key thing though is the sort of combination of the mechanical elements that make this game feel so different. Like even though it looks like an old game, and even though we've all played all these really incredible 8-bit games that we, you know, discussed that it reminds us of, there are little things like in one of the early stages, you hit these like bubbles off the ground, and they like it makes them rise off the ground. And if you jump and hit them again, it rises up even higher, and that sets up little areas where you can basically design a little. They design a puzzle in the stage that leads to you having to jump in a certain way to get up to a higher location. Yeah. It's got, there's like in many games, there's secret areas where you hit a wall to find an, you know, hidden treasure chest or whatever. And oftentimes that wall is marked with some sort of thing that lets you know, hey, there's a treasure here. And I usually don't like that. I love that there are secrets, but I usually don't like it when the secrets are marked. This game has both marked walls with where secrets are and unmarked walls. So if you're looking extra hard, you can find more secrets that most players or I don't know, maybe most players won't find. And that always makes me feel smarter when I'm playing the game.
You're almost always rewarded for experimentation, which is awesome.
Yeah, exactly. And then one of the stages I was playing recently, it's like a lava stage. And it's like, how many times have you played a fire stage in a game, in an old, you know, platforming game before? But I loved that they introduced this element with these sort of like green slime balls that turn the flames into basically bounce pads. And those, there's a timer on them so that, you know, it doesn't take very long before all of a sudden it's fire again and not the bouncy slime. So there's a bunch of puzzles that take that into account. And beyond all that, of course, you do have an inventory that you keep with additional items that you can use, and the sort of determining when to use those, like the one I've been using a lot is basically a second and a half or 2 second invincibility that lets you do things like walk on the one hit death spikes. I love all that stuff. So I feel like it's just like such a great combination of all these old elements, but we never played this game before. Back when Spelunky first came out, not the version that's available, you know, widely available now, but the original like free PC release that had graphics that looked 8-bit, like an old Zelda game or whatever, I remember saying that this game would have been my favorite NES game if it had come out back in that era. Like it's something that felt like totally retro, but also new and deep and fun. And I think this game's a similar thing. Like if this game had come out back then, you know, with less colors and no widescreen support, whatever, it would be a game that it's so fondly looked back upon. So they really just hit this like perfect combination of elements that, you know, will keep players like us engaged for a long time. I think anyone who lived through the NES era and looks back on it fondly, I think is just going to get a true kick out of it. And no matter what platform you get it on, you'll probably end up having a great time as long as you have a good controller to play with.
Yeah.
And you started on it, Ryan. I think what's awesome, what they do really well, is that twist or their take on the Mario lava level, snow level, or even the Mega Man, you know, each boss kind of has a theme to their level. What I love about this game is that each night's level very much has that feel to it, but they also iterate on mechanics that you learn at earlier levels. And I feel like that's a new addition to this type of game. You know, Mega Man has some of that where if you beat the bosses in the right level, it makes then subsequent bosses easier to beat. Like there's the best way to clear the eight bosses in Mega Man. Right. But I love that like you learn this bouncing shovel mechanic or the green bouncy guys, or, you know, breaking through walls to find secrets, and then you're in a lava level, and then you're using this thing that you've learned from the wind level to propel you across. It's a really, really fresh, I think, way to interpret that type of approach to game design, and it's pretty awesome.
The only thing I think that might have made it feel a little bit more modern, which again, that's not necessarily what they were going for, but imagine if instead of starting on the world map at the left end and working your way to the right and still having some choice over which level you go to next, but imagine if they'd put you in the center of the map and you could go to any stage that you wanted in any order without the locks there. That would have been you know, something that made it feel so much more modern and different.
Yeah, that's actually a really awesome idea. Very cool. There's a really interesting article, too, on Gamasutra talking about how this game actually could not be put out on the NES, how it really does take advantage of modern technology in some really interesting ways. You mentioned the 16.9 support, but lots of other stuff, too. That background parallax really wasn't possible until the Super Nintendo. Sprite flickering, which is something that plagued the original NES, they fixed, you know, in this game. It's a really interesting article. I recommend you guys checking it out. It's David D'Angelo wrote on Gamasutra. I have to thank our second sponsor, Mac Mini Colo. Mac Mini Colo, we love them. The original Mac Mini hosting company. They make it so easy to set up and maintain without the hassle of a setup fee. They have a world-class data center currently hosting hundreds of Mac Minis for satisfied customers from over 40 different countries around the world. And Mac Mini Colo makes sure you get great high performance no matter where you are. Never worry about having to run out of space because you can get up to 2 terabytes of storage and up to 16 gigabytes of RAM. And if you want even more power than that, you got to check out MacProColo.net, where they provide colocation services for your new Mac Pro. So just remember, Mac Mini Colo is where low cost meets high performance to create the perfect Mac server. Just visit MacMiniColo.net/5x5. That's Mac, M-A-C, Mini, M-I-N-I, Colo, colo.net/5x5 to learn more about Mac Mini Colo, who supports this show, and we hope you support them in return. Christian, what is on your playlist other than Shovel Knight?
Yeah, so I was in New York City. I just got back very early this morning. I was there for the UCB does the Del Close Marathon, a big improv marathon. And then I had a bunch of stand-up shows out there. And thanks to the few listeners I was able to see and say hi to after shows, that was cool. But Shovel Knight was perfect for me for that because I was on the go. And then the way I visit a city, it's like Lady Liberty, seen it, don't need to go there. Pizza, of course I'm eating it. But then I love to go to big cities and seek out their mom and pop or the cool video game stores. So I was on that hunt, and I picked up a Retron 5 while I was in New York City, what I have not been able to find here in Los Angeles yet, and hooked that bad boy up to my hotel TV, and I was playing Killer Instinct, Super Nintendo version, Lion King on the Super Nintendo, and the original Donkey Kong Country also on Super Nintendo all through the Retron, and just having a blast retro gaming. And if you don't know about the Retron 5, it's an emulator. You know, you use the original cart, but it dumps the ROM into, you know, their top level, and you're playing a ROM but with the cart plugged in. And it supports, let's see, I have all these Super Nintendo, Nintendo, Genesis, also I think Mega Drive with an adapter, and Japanese or Nintendo or Super Nintendo, and then also Game Boy and Game Boy Advance games. And it has original, it comes with a Bluetooth controller that's kind of not the best in the world, but it works. And then it also has controller ports for Super Nintendo, Genesis, and NES actual controllers to plug in. And I mean, it's not perfect. It's not playing it on the OG consoles for real. But it's pretty cool. Like, I'm a fan of, even though it's dumping the ROM onto the system, once you take the cart out, it's not saving it there. I'm a fan of playing games off carts, or at least having it look like I am. Like, I like plugging in the cart, and I think that's cool. The way I would describe the Retron 5, though, like, it for those three games, it worked, I think, flawlessly. But it's this may be a weird analogy, but I think it makes sense, so hopefully it does. Playing retro games, or plugging in your cart into the Retron, is kind of like playing a free-to-play game, in that, you know, I'm playing Lion King on Super Nintendo, which is a super hard game for poor design and also just for tiny little platforms you need to land on. And as I'm playing it, you know, with the original Super Nintendo controller plugged in, when I don't make jumps that I know I made when I was little, I'm questioning, like, are my skills off? Did I not make that? Or did this not rip the ROM perfectly? And, like, is there a glitch? Because it doesn't read every game perfect. Or is there an input delay? And so it's kind of like free to play when you're playing and you hit a difficult level. And it's like, could I do this if I pay? You know what I mean? Would I be able to clear this stage if I had put money in to get better gems or whatever? So it's always this little double-edged sword when something doesn't go the way you want it to. It's like, oh, is that a glitch in the original NES game, or is the Retron glitching a little bit? But I love it. I mean, so it's not perfect, but it has those five or six systems in it that sits in my console. My entertainment cabinet is only the one thing there, and I get to play these old games again. And it's HDMI out, and you know, you can add filters to make it look more CRT screened and not as perfect as, I forget the box that James Stevenson has, you know, from Japan that was like $300 that does it really, really well. You know, this isn't that quality of making them look scan lined or whatever, but it's, I paid a little over $100 for it and I'm super happy with it. That's my short take on the Retron, but man, old games. Who
do you, when you boot it up, do you go accessing the Retron? because that's what I would do. I would yell that at the top of my lungs.
Well, now that you said that and we have it recorded, I will play you saying that.
Awesome.
It's cool.
I guess I'm the only one that's been playing. No, that's not true. I have been playing a modern game with 3D graphics, guys. It's crazy. I know. They have those now. WildStar. I've talked about it before. I'm going to keep talking about it because I'm hooked.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to hate it again.
No.
I thought we were on a bell curve. It's like the worst, the best. It's the worst.
No. It took a little while for me to find the love, but I am full on in love zone with this game. I'm an MMO freak, so, take it with a grain of salt. It is very MMO-y. What I love about the game is not what I do most of the time with the game, which is bizarre and sort of self-defeating and it flies directly in opposition to what I was talking about at the top of the show this week about, you know, quests and following directions and thinking outside the box, because 80% of the time I'm playing this game, I'm doing that, and it's not great. That part of the game, the 80%, is pretty rote. It is, however, very beautiful, wonderfully designed, and the combat system inherently is just fun. They have found this way to make those telegraphs, those red shapes that go on the ground, unique to each enemy that you fight, different and challenging and fun. It's just fun to have to dodge in and out of those things to figure out how to do your rotation whilst moving and you know, compensating for where those telegraphs are going to be. So that is great. The questing system is not particularly interesting. I think it's very MMO-y. It's very just do this, go to the next thing, do this, level up, level up, level up, which is what I've been doing. I was level 20 last week. I'm level 32 this week. I've been playing like crazy. But the other 20% of the game is so phenomenally entertaining that it makes the questing stuff a necessary evil. And that is dungeoning, adventuring, all of the wonderful short group content that this game knocks out of the park. Two adventures I did this week. One of them, I didn't do both of them, but I heard about the first one because my group did it. It's sort of a mini MOBA, which is wonderful inside the context of this MMO. But the one that I did do is a mini tower defense game inside the context of a MOBA, which is wildly fun. The fact that they kind of brought those mechanics into the MMO space and the way that that is realized is very cool. But the dungeons are just so fun because the boss battles, the trash is actually challenging. It's not just, you know, just mow through the trash to get to the bosses. The trash is challenging, but also the bosses are so well designed. Even low level dungeons, even the first few dungeons you go into, the way that they make their attacks and the dances you have to do in and out, the different phases you have to be aware of. It's like end level stuff in most MMOs, but it's happening early on in WildStar, which is great. They also knocked out of the park the customization stuff. The thing, it's so interesting having played Elder Scrolls Online back to back with this, because they are like yin and yang with each other. All the things that Elder Scrolls did right, WildStar just has no interest in. And all the things that WildStar does right, Elder Scrolls completely failed at, which is your character looks awesome. Customizing him is fun and easy. You have costumes. They all look wild and are interesting. You can put dyes on them and make them look how you want. You have the ability to bling out your dude and make him look very specific to you. And the sort of cartoonish sci-fi aesthetic is really satisfying. Also, and when you get new gear, it's really exciting, which never was in Elder Scrolls. Also, this player housing thing, which I kind of mentioned in passing last week, I never thought that I'd be the guy that liked player housing. It's really fun the way they've implemented it in WildStar. You loot items that give you rest bonuses when you rest at your house, and you can place them in and around your house in any fashion you choose. You can change the size, you can rotate them, you can create weird contraptions. My house looks like this bizarre psychedelic, insane clown house because I just make everything gigantic. I got like a puma rug that's like this dead puma, and I made it enormous. And it just like lets you be silly and wacky and different. But better than that, you can loot items that literally create areas on your land, on your property, at your house that lead to dungeons, that lead to challenges, that let you loot things. So you can invite your friends over to your quote-unquote house and go and do a really fun short dungeon. We had one my friend looted and put in his house that is like this three-stage dungeon where you have an agility test, you have this jump puzzle that's really cool, and then you have a big boss battle that was really challenging. And all of that happened like in the context of something that he owns that only he has because he looted it, which makes it really satisfying from an MMO player's perspective. I'm having a blast with WildStar. I can't stop playing it. I want to play it all the time. It's got its hooks into me big time. The thing it just doesn't do at all, which Elder Scrolls did really well, is convey any sense of story, tell me, make me invested in what the quest's outcomes are, give me any kind of choice in that sense. It's just very much the WoW model of at least how I've been playing it. And, you know, part of that is on me. But it's because there's no reason to not do it this way, but I just click through. I just click on the quest. Tell me the six things I need to kill. Tell me the 14 things I need to collect. And I go and I do it. But, you know, as soon as I get to 50, all that will be behind me and I'll be back to just kind of raiding and doing end level content, which is really where the meat and potatoes fun of this game is.
So if you had to recommend, is it, you know, different strokes for different folks? Or is it, if you had to recommend someone that is looking to jump into a new MMO or take a break from WoW for a little bit and they're looking at Elder Scrolls or WildStar, can you recommend one over the other, or are they just, if you like story, play Elder Scrolls, if you like sweet loots, WildStar?
Yeah, I mean, I can break it down that way. I think if you're a WoW player, it'll feel like a comfortable shoe to jump into WildStar. I mean, there's a lot of interesting differences, like the combat system, like the leveling system. Oh, that's the other big thing that WildStar does so right that I happen to really love. And it's much more along the lines of what Diablo 3 does, which is you can change your loadout, change your skill set at any time. And you're constantly trying new things. You don't have to pay to respec, although you have to pay to respec your amps, which is a whole other story. But it allows you to drop in and drop out certain skills based on need, which I think is really fun. So there are key differences from WoW, but it is very much more a traditional MMO in a large sense. I think people will disagree with me, but I think that Elder Scrolls is a fantastic game if you like Elder Scrolls games. I think it's a fantastic – I felt like a single-player game writ large. It felt like, to me, this wonderful story that I'm invested in when I play role-playing games, all the, you know, spoken dialogue, all the interesting quests that were really well-written. It just had other people running around at the same time that I could potentially team up with. So, you know, if those are the kinds of games that you prefer, I think you would really enjoy Elder Scrolls. But you probably don't really care about having other people in your game, so it probably isn't worth the $15 a month fee, which is, I think, the problem that Elder Scrolls is running into at this point, is that people are going, well, I like these kinds of games, but I usually don't have to pay a monthly fee for them. So, are you an MMO guy, Ryan?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, that's part of what's got me a little worried about whether or not, how much I'm going to like Destiny, because it feels like such an MMO.
Yeah.
And I really feel like my enjoyment of it would dramatically increase. In fact, so part of when you were talking about WildStar, and you were saying that the story isn't what's, you know, making you want to play. Mm-hmm. It reminded me a little bit of what we were talking about with Minecraft, you know, about like just being dropped into a world and doing these, you know, just like exploring it and this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. In something like Destiny, when I was playing the alpha, what I was really wishing for was, instead of having to run to a beacon, start a little mission to go kill five guys or go grab 10 things out of a thing, you know, I'd much rather just be put in the world with some enemies in it and then look off in the distance and see a giant fortress there, and then have to infiltrate that and kill a boss and have the story be told to me a little bit less, I don't know, hand-holdy sort of way.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that those elements, a lot of what makes the MMO genre MMO, as far as we know it, because of games like EverQuest and World of Warcraft, and as you know, that sort of stuff is a turnoff for me. Just the sort of meat and potatoes quests, I'm just not into. And so, yeah. And I honestly, if I was interested in the idea of playing games like that, then I don't think the monthly fee would bother me too much. Although, obviously, it seems like so much is free to play now. It does seem like a little strange and weird that a new game has come out with this model right now that's not something that, say, Blizzard made.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting position for MMOs because WildStar is putting out their first major free content patch in just a few days. It's called The Strain, and I think that they're really making a commitment to saying, hey, we're going to put out hefty amounts of content regularly to kind of justify that fee. And I think that the onus is on these games to do that now. It's to say, hey, if you're paying us a monthly fee, we recognize that a lot of these companies are giving you content. We got to have a lot of it in order to make that monthly fee seem justifiable.
Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting. I'm just having so much fun with it. It's one of those games that I think about all the time, and yet I'm just kind of blasting through mindlessly through the quest system and not paying attention to anybody's story, anybody's this or anybody's that. It's just not delivered in a way that's particularly interesting to me. Even though the design of the world is really interesting, the look and feel of everything is really interesting. You know, I just got to a new area where it's on a moon, and so it's low gravity. So every time you jump, you go much farther and you float a little more because I've never experienced that.
Are there
that.
Wizards there?
Yes, there are wizards there. I've never experienced that in an MMO, you know, and this MMO has a lot of platforming to it. It does a lot of things differently while at the same time doing a lot of things the same. So you kind of have to know what you're getting into. I also have a hoverboard, which any game where it lets me have a hoverboard, I'm pretty much going to geek out over.
Not bad, not bad.
Yeah.
It's so funny because the game that I've been playing, I'm sure anyone who follows me on Twitter knows, is Titanfall. I can't stop playing it. And I know that it's not for any people. And the funny thing is that, like, there's like a core progression that is the regeneration system, which is like the prestige system in Call of Duty, where you just, you know, level up, level up, level up, and then eventually you start yourself over from the very beginning. And the only incentive to do that is a little badge by your name, and the fact that metagame, part of the like requirements for regenerating is that you play the game with different sets of weapons and complete different challenges than you ordinarily would. So it sort of takes you out of your typical comfort zone in the way that you might want to play the first time you're playing through it, and play it in a totally different way. Yeah. Say like with a sniper rifle or something like that, which is not, you know, I'm not a sniper to begin with, and I certainly don't want to use a sniper rifle in a fast moving, you know, highly vertical game like Titanfall. But I'm getting to the point where that's, you know, in order to advance anymore, you know, that's what I'm going to have to do. And that is just enough of a carrot to keep me playing. Even though I don't feel like I would really need it. Like back when I used to play Quake on PC all the time, I just played because I enjoyed playing, and it was good to feel like I was getting better at the game, mm-hmm. like constantly getting a little bit better. And now I feel like I like that the carrot is so is small. Like it's there. It's just enough of a thing in the distance to keep me playing. But I don't feel like if I stopped right now, I wouldn't feel like I didn't achieve something, you know. It's like a sort of perfect thing to keep me involved in the game sort of consistently. And as someone who, you know, worked in the Game Express for many years and has sort of since left, but really I do end up playing a lot of games, not every game, but a lot of games, it's nice to sort of have focused on one game that I can just like give most of my time to. And I still dabble in other games, but I always come back to it. And it's like it reminds me of back when I used to play Street Fighter as a kid. It's just a great feeling to be able to really focus. And I'm sure that's what a lot of people get out of MMOs.
That's a lot of what I get out of Hearthstone, honestly. It's like,
yeah.
Hearthstone is my sort of constant companion. I play other games come and go, but Hearthstone is my daily. I do my daily quests. I get my gold. I'm always having that in my back pocket. So it is interesting to have a deeper connection with games and not just have this passing, you know, what game am I playing this week? There's this one that I always come back to. It's cool. Speaking of always going back to things, we have to thank our third sponsor, Shopify. Shopify is a hosted e-commerce solution that allows you to set up and run your own online store in minutes. Pick a template, add your products, pick your payment processor from PayPal to Stripe to Authorize.net, and ship your stuff with just a few clicks. With Shopify, it's easy to sell online, and there's no software to download, host, upgrade, or maintain. You can pick from over 100 professionally designed e-commerce templates or create your own with full control over the HTML and CSS. There are no bandwidth limits and no need to worry about scaling when your store becomes popular. And every Shopify store is level 1 PCI DSS compliant and totally secure. Shopify has just announced their Shopify Point of Sale. It's an iPad application that lets you sell your Shopify store's products in a physical retail setting. It's quick and easy. Browse your store's catalog, pick a customer's products, swipe their credit card, and print their receipt or send it through email. You can automatically sync products and orders, and there's only one dashboard to manage all your retail and online stores. So get Shopify Point of Sale hardware, which includes a credit card reader, cash drawer, iPad stand, and receipt printer. Order online and shipping is free. So visit shopify.com/5x5 and you'll get 3 months free. That's shopify.com/5x5. Check them out today. All you need is something to sell. We thank Shopify for supporting DLC and hope you support them in return. Christian, anything else on your playlist, or is that you were traveling man this week, huh?
Yeah, I was traveling. I mean, I'll be spending more time with those retro games as we go forward, and I'll talk more about them then, what holds up, what doesn't, and what's fun and what's not. So look for that.
All right, let's wrap the show up with a little bit of tabletop time. Right now. Ryan, do you play board games?
I guess the short answer is not that often, no. But I really love them every time I play. I just don't have a crew. I'm starting one of my coworkers and one of my good friends, Matt Chandernay, is a big board gamer and is recently tried to get us into a other tabletop games and role playing games as well. So he started up a Shadowrun campaign that I'm supposed to take part in. I rolled up a character, but we just haven't got that game off the ground yet. But I'm hoping that becomes like a stepping stone into playing more stuff.
Oh yeah, so, man, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, and I the more I hear about a Netrunner, the more I want to play that as well. So yeah, I'm right there. It's right there sitting in front of me, and I'm trying to keep my eye on the prize. But I haven't gotten too into it yet, I must say.
Well, I'll have to have Matt on the show as well. I'm a fan of his stuff as well. What were you saying, Christian?
Before you dive too deep into what you've been playing or what you've been seeing, let me just say there ain't no thing like Cards Against Humanity until you play with some of the best improvisers in the world. I don't know how much we played and how much was just one-upping each other, because like someone would play a card and then other people would just go on tag runs. The best / worst way to play a game.
Awesome.
That's fantastic. I do play, I have played my fair share of Cards Against Humanity. I always forget about it because it's just, to me, it's less a tabletop game and more of a we're really drunk and now what do we do?
Exactly.
Cards Against Humanity.
That's so great. I'm glad you brought up Netrunner, Android Netrunner, because I wanted to talk a little bit this week about two-player games, because by far, the most common question that I get on Twitter is, hey, can you suggest some two-player games for my girlfriend and myself or my buddy and myself? I don't have a large group of people, but I want to play two-player games. Anything good? I must have answered that question 50 times. And I'm always happy to do so, but I figured might as well talk about it here and give people the same groupings of games that I always respond on Twitter with, so people can maybe check them out, because there are lots of really awesome options of two-player games. My go-to, and Android Netrunner is a fantastic one, although it is a financial, let's just say, hook that might get you going. You know, it's like saying, like recommending Magic to people. Although not quite as bad. But yeah, great game. Closed Circuits, you know, games that you can buy once and be done with and will give you a lot of fun two-player-wise. I always go to one particular game designer, Renner Knizia, who's sort of old school at this point, but he was one of the biggest game designers in the world several years ago. And a lot of his games get criticized for not having very strong themes. They're all sort of mathy. But I think that makes them easy to introduce to people that aren't as familiar with games, that have maybe only played, you know, a regular deck of cards, because, you know, deck of cards is basically numbers. So two of his games in particular I always recommend to people, the first being Battle Line, which is a fantastic two-player game where you're basically, you each have a deck of cards that have numbers and colors, the sort of like an Uno deck where the colors and numbers are varied. And you're trying to create runs in specific rows in front of you, and you're fighting over these rows. So each person is trying to win their side of that row by placing patterns and scoring points based on those patterns, and you're trying to disrupt somebody's pattern so that you win the side instead of them. You score the most points on that side. And whoever wins five patterns, whoever wins five of those lines, those battle lines first, is the winner. It's a fantastically fun game, really strategic, easy to teach, and the modern packaging from GMT Games has a sort of expansion-y bit in it where there's like specialty cards that you can play that'll like mess with your opponent and break some of the rules, which is really fun. Another one of his games that's easy to recommend for two players is called Lost Cities, and this, in the same way, you're collecting runs of numbers and trying to have them in the right patterns, and you're sitting across from each other and you're trying to anticipate what the other player is going to put down so that you can figure out which cards to risk and which runs to start so that they don't mess you up. Really, really fun games. Again, very simple to learn, very simple to teach. If you want to kind of go into much more thematic and much more sort of nerdy pursuits, I also always recommend Summoner Wars. Summoner Wars is a fantastic game from Plaid Hat Games, where you each have groups of fantasy characters that spawn from a specific point. You place them onto your field and move them around in very specific ways that's relative to their unit style and their attack method. And you're trying, it's kind of like a chessboard where you're moving your characters around and attacking other people, and you're trying to destroy their summoning point before they destroy yours. Another game where you could end up spending a lot of money because there's a lot of extra new factions that have been released and new decks that have been released in the subsequent years since that game came out. Those are three of my go-to picks for two-player games, but I also recommend Le Havre, which is actually my favorite board game in the world, and it works great with two players. I think it's best with three players, in fact, but it works great with two players, and it's a game I've talked about here before. It's a Uwe Rosenberg game, and it's all about shipping and building buildings and turning some goods into other goods, and you feel super powerful because you have all these different kinds of goods that you're creating and maintaining and turning into other things and building boats and building buildings and stuff. It's really fun. So those are four two-player games that I always recommend to people, and hopefully that's helpful for folks that are trying to get two-player games going. But there's several of those are available on iOS also. Acornio in the chat room just pointed out that Lost Cities is available on iOS, as is Le Havre. And I think Summoner Wars is as well. So those are some...
Was Is Lost Cities on iOS designed? Do you know if the team that did that is the same team that did Carcassonne for?
It very well may be. I don't know that for certain, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I Carcassonne is one game that I just keep on my my front home screen in iOS. It's like one of my favorite, asynchronous multiplayer games. It's really, really great.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's a great game and a wonderful iOS implementation. It's really conveys the sense of the game well. Absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
Awesome, dudes. Well, this has been a very fun episode. Thanks so much for joining us, Ryan.
No problem at all. It was, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, it's been great. Can you tell the people where to find your stuff or what you're doing if they're interested?
Yeah, sure. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan O'Donnell. That's RyanODonnell. Or look us up on our website. It's at http://. That's the important part. Area5.tv.
Thanks for including the HTTP. Most people forget that. And yeah.
It's my favorite part of the URL. So I just want to make sure people have that.
Christian, what about you? What is your HTTP doing this week?
If you're listening live, I'm in San Diego tomorrow. Then I'm doing Sketch Melt on Thursday here in Los Angeles, which is a sketch show with some great people, some people I haven't worked with since I did a CBS showcase a couple of years ago, a sketch showcase where they'll be on the show. The 10th is Improv versus Stand Up back here at UCB Los Angeles. And then the 15th is What's New, which is my Nerdist stand-up podcast / live show. And you can find that stuff either at UCB's website or at nerdmeltla.com or just following me on Twitter, SPICER, which, despite my pleading with them, I cannot use my last name on Nintendo consoles for things because it's flagged as a swear word.
Spicer is a swear word?
Well, get rid of the ER and then it's a problem, I think, is their issue with it. Which I get, but it's weird. Anyway.
Yeah.
And thank you to everyone we've had some recent kind iTunes reviews. If you are listening live and you're in the chat, even if you don't use iTunes regularly, if you have an account, go in and give us a review. It might seem silly and trivial, but it really does help, and it helps us get the show out to other people. And really the best thing you can do for the show is tell your friends about us. If you enjoy listening, tell a friend and tell them to do the same, because we love doing it, and we'd love to keep doing it. So tell your friends and keep the good times rolling.
I completely forgot to do calls. I promised people I was going to do calls, and I completely forgot. Let's do a quick call because I promised it, and there's people online on the line. I'm a terrible host of this show. 661, you're on the line. I apologize. What did you want to talk about?
Hey, gang. This is Michael from Amsterdam. It's been a while. So there's two things I wanted to talk about. First, a story that actually came out, I think, over the weekend about a game that's coming out in Europe on the Wii U and 3DS Squid's Odyssey. And it's going to be the first game on Nintendo consoles that's going to be cross-buy. So if you buy the 3DS version, the Wii U version you're going to get for free. And there's an article on it on Silicon Era, which is stating that they could do it for Europe, but for some reason, North America could not support it. The other thing that I wanted to share was what I was playing, and unfortunately, I'm not playing Shovel Knight, even though I'm a Kickstarter backer, but Europe is not available yet, so I have to wait. But I was playing Kirby again because of Yoshi's Woolly Yarn. So I guess, yeah, and it's people really mocked it for being a kiddie game, and I can kind of understand it, but at the same time, if you play long enough, you do actually get some challenging levels. So I think people were too harsh on it, to be honest.
I certainly wasn't. I loved Kirby, Kirby's Epic Yarn. Yes. Oh, God, I love that game. I adore that game. It's full of whimsy, and it was challenging, absolutely.
I also love it. I think that the mechanically, it's so beautiful. It's like really simple. You just play with a D-pad and like two buttons or something like that. But like double tapping to dash and like the way that the different mechanics like flow into each other, I just felt like, oh, only Nintendo can make games feel this good when they look like this. It was just magic. Yeah, I love that game.
I agree. And the idea that we're going to get a Yarn game like that, but in HD, I mean, it's not going to be a Kirby game, but that Yarn aesthetic is so beautiful, and seeing it in HD at E3, I was just like, oh yes, finally. It's just a world you want to be in. It's great.
100% agree. Yeah.
And I've had my eye on this Squid's Odyssey for a while. This game looks awesome. It's a action strategy RPG that is coming out for 3DS. I love the idea of this cross-buy stuff, but I'm a little bummed it's not, if I haven't heard about this not happening in North America thing, but if what he was saying is correct, that it's not happening in North America, that is a shame. I think Nintendo would be smart to do more of that, as Sony has been successful in doing it.
Yeah, like I said before, I just feel spoiled by cross-buy. When I don't like to have to make the decision like I did with Shovel Knight, which is like, where do I play this game? Do I play it at home? Do I play it on the go? And I think if it's not even just the PlayStation platforms that have spoiled us, it's iOS, right? Like, you buy a game once on your iPhone and you want to play it on iPad as well.
Yeah.
It's just the way it works now. And I would wish it seems strange that there would be a technical limitation that would keep it working in one region, or make it work in one region and not
that
work in another.
Like bull.
But yeah, exactly. So I really hope that they sort that out, because I would have gone with Shovel Knight on Nintendo platforms if that had been worked out.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, I sort of stick that right at the end there. I completely forgot we didn't have phones last week, and there you go. Anyway, but thanks again, Ryan, for being on the show. If you want to see my stuff this week, at Jeff Cannata with two N's and one T is how you follow me, jeffcannata.com also. Listen to me on the Slash Filmcast. We'll be talking about Transformers 4 this week, so you can listen and hear my brain explode, which is always entertaining. And my YouTube channel is going strong as well. Check that out, youtube.com/CannataJeff. Thanks a lot, guys, for listening. Next week, we're going to have game designer David Eckelberry on the show. He's the game director of Fable Legends, so I think we got him locked in and should be an entertaining show as well. So that'll be next Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific time, if you want to listen live. And until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.